We come together in worship with words from the Reverend Ed Atkinson, who was minister at this church from 1964 to 1969. And I'm looking out at least a few people who remember him as your minister. He wrote, "We meet together to celebrate who we are, to share the insights which give meaning and hope to our lives, to learn from the wisdom of others, that their truths may contribute to our understanding. We meet, we share, we learn, we celebrate our coming together." I now invite you to turn to the words of chalice lighting on this soon-to-be election time there by Abraham Lincoln, I think appropriately, and our chalice will be lit this morning by Ginger Dreyer. "I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live to what light I am." Blessed Spirit of our lives, Spirit of love and life and justice, we feel your presence in this gathered time. We thank you for the joys and ask for your grace upon the concerns that have been shared here today. We pray for comfort, healing, and peace for all those facing illness and grief. We especially remember those affected by Hurricane Sandy as they begin the process of recovering, moving forward with their lives. We pray that all voices will be heard on Tuesday as we come together as a nation to vote. We joyfully welcome our new members who've joined First Parish Church this morning. And we give thanks for the service and support that longtime members and those throughout the generations have given to this church. Great Spirit of Light, be our guide. Help us to see all our blessings. Shine forth the light of truth in our lives, and help us to hear the still small voice inside of us. Let us know serenity. Fill us with compassion. Clear our minds of fear and confusion. Radiate clarity and peace from our inner beings. And let joy find a home in our hearts this day, and let love be our legacy. Our reading this morning is from that great preacher at Riverside Church in New York, William Sloan Coffin. It's from his book, Credo. "I think we can say that democracy is a form of government that demands more virtue of its citizens than any other form of government. But I do not think we can say that democracy guarantees that virtue will be exercised. So let us term freedom of choice less a virtue than a necessity, a precondition for real freedom, which is the ability to make choices that are generous, loving, and wise. Our wills are not free when they will what is bigoted, narrow, ungenerous. Our wills are only free when they can will the will of a loving God. Where every door is open wide for all who choose to step inside." I want to begin this sermon by once again welcoming not just June, but all those who joined the church this morning at our earlier service. You know, everyone, members or not, are welcome to participate in our worship and in all the programs we offer. Everyone, members or not, will be served by our ministry when they're in times of need. But you, June, and all those others who joined today, now as members, join the ranks of those who have the right to be full participants in this democratically run institution. You now have the right to vote for those who will lead our church and serve as chairs of committees. You have the right not only to vote for those who will represent you, but also to vote directly on major issues that affect this congregation. You'll be voting soon on a major capital improvements project. You vote each year on our budget, and in our tradition, When it's time for transition, you even get to vote for who the minister is. That doesn't happen in most churches. Most churches are not run democratically as we are. And truth be told, this democracy of ours sometimes can be a bit cumbersome, time-consuming, and sometimes even a bit of a messy process. Our reason for supporting the use of the democratic process in our churches is not because it's more expedient. The reason we value the democratic process is not practical, nor is it political. It's theological. We as a church believe in this process because it is the manifestation of an even more fundamental belief. That is our belief in the equal worth and dignity of every person. The belief that everyone's voice is important, not just the voices of the rich or the powerful. For the last several weeks, I've been spending both Wednesday evenings and Thursday mornings teaching sessions of a new to UU course to more than a dozen people here at church. Together, we've explored the historical journey of the Free Church, its theological journey that has moved away from the belief in a divine predetermined plan where every human action was preset by God, to a view where human beings have free choice to determine their own path, a view that says we all have the capacity to shape our lives and our country and our world. This view of human nature, along with the acknowledgement that we all have the same inherent dignity and worth, and that we are committed to equality, requires that democracy be a fundamental principle in the Free Church tradition. This inclusion of the democratic process as one of our fundamental religious principles often comes as a surprise to new folks in our tradition. You know, it doesn't sound like a religious thing, but for us, it truly is. The famous Unitarian Universalist minister, A. Powell Davies, said, "Democracy is in fact the social and political expression of a religious principle." So that brings me to what I want to talk about this morning. Next Tuesday, I hope every one of you will exercise your sacred right to vote, to be part of that democratic process. We as a church affirm in our principles. We will not all vote the same way for president or for other offices. Some of us will be sad the day after the election. Others of us will be ecstatic. That is assuming that the election is not so close that it takes weeks to count and recount ballots. And in that case, I think we'll all just be anxious. But assuming that there's a decisive outcome the day after the election, we'll have a variety of different feelings about our future based on who we are and who wins. But the question I want to explore with you today is what might we, or could we, all feel, maybe even embrace, the day after the election, regardless of who wins and what side we were on? To answer this question, I think we need to look back not at the positions of the candidates, but at the process itself, and then look ahead to how we will engage with each other across different political positions after the election. You know, there are many things that have greatly concerned me about this election. Central among these concerns about what is happening is what is happening to the process itself. You know, it's too long, it's too cumbersome, it's distorted in favor of a few states getting all the attention because of the way the Electoral College system is set up. And did any of you hear the interview on NPR this week with the 4-year-old girl who was asked why she was crying? Because she was tired of Obama and Romney. And I think she's not alone. But these issues pale in comparison to another. My greatest concern about our democratic process is with the amount of money in politics and the power that it has to influence the outcome of political races at all levels of government And then the government policies that the officials this money helped to elect will pursue. I'd like to believe on the day after the election that the election was not bought. But I'm sickened by the amount of money that has been spent in this campaign season. I'm sure you heard on the news this week that the Romney and Obama campaigns together passed the $2 billion mark in fundraising. And another $3 billion has been raised by PACs, super PACs, and special interests. Moreover, certain individuals have given tens of millions of dollars to those groups to essentially buy influence for the candidates. This has happened on both sides of the political aisle. And I'm not talking about one candidate here or even just about the presidential election. I'm talking about both parties at all levels are grabbing for every dollar, and those with big money just seem to not be able to wait to give it. I know that this is all defended in the name of free speech, and it's sadly, my opinion, been legitimized by the recent Supreme Court decision. But I am not buying the idea that we cannot reform this system. To me, it feels obscene. It feels morally wrong. Think of how many people you could help with $5 billion. Think of how many young people you could educate with $5 billion. You know, you could even make a dent in the national debt with $5 billion. It's clear that money will have a huge effect on the outcome of this election, and even more so on the policies advanced by whomever is the winner. You know, a recent study showed that 85% of the time, the person who raised the most money won the election. The real issue here is that this undue influence of money sets up a profound inequality in the political system, where one voice is able to drown out millions of others. You know, if you give $1 million, your opinion is worth a lot more than mine. The day after the election, I think we need to stop denying the obvious and face the fact that our political system is corrupted by money. Regardless of which candidate, which party, by constitutional amendment or whatever means is required, I think we need to work to stop this. Elections need to be publicly financed so candidates are not beholden to special interest groups and wealthy individuals and are truly free to vote for those things that are actually in the best interest of their constituents. The next thing that I'd like to believe the day after the election, regardless of who wins, is that we did not just vote our own self-interest, but we voted for what we believed was the best interest of all. As a religious tradition, we don't affirm and promote the democratic process to the exclusion of all other moral principles. It does not and it should not stand alone as we approach issues in our society and in our church. It's not our only principle, and if it were, we would be in serious trouble. Both our church and our government have to be more than just the expression of the selfish views of the majority of people. The democratic process, like any kind of governance, has its weaknesses and is subject to abuse. Winston Churchill famously wrote that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. Raw, self-interested, every person for themselves democracy will never produce justice and will not move us forward as either an institution or a nation. As the great social justice preacher of the Riverside Church in New York, William Sloan Coffin, said in that reading I shared, democracy does not guarantee that virtue will be exercised. It's exactly because the democratic process has this potential negative side that it's only one half of our fifth religious principle. The fifth principle reads in its entirety, we affirm and promote the right of conscience and the democratic process within our congregations and our society at large. It's only by pairing a well-developed conscience with the use of the democratic process, that we're able to make decisions that go beyond our small self-interests. It's only when conscience is combined with the democratic process that we make decisions that are generous, loving, and wise. It is conscience that can keep us from abusing the democratic process. Indeed, it's the role of religion to bring conscience to the democratic process. You know, good people can differ on decisions of conscience. But I would like to believe, the day after the election, that each person's vote was guided by an honest conscience. I'd like to believe on the day after the election, regardless of who wins, that we as a society did all we could to welcome and count every citizen's vote. Over the last several years, and particularly leading up to this election, 33 state legislatures have passed some form of what's called voter ID laws. There's also been action taken in several states to limit early voting, and two states have repealed Election Day registration laws. These actions have the effect of preventing many qualified people from voting. Several have been already blocked in their implementation by courts who found just that, and other such laws are now being reviewed by appellate courts. Now, some argue that this is all an attempt to prevent voter fraud. But when questioned what fraud has there been, they have little to point to. In fact, almost every study done indicates that there is very little voter fraud, and there are already plenty of laws that deal directly with that issue. I believe the argument is really a cover to hide what I believe is an intentional effort to deny the vote to certain kinds of people that those who support these laws don't believe will vote with them. Moreover, there have been many instances of outright fraud and intimidation in this election season. Did you hear about the official-looking letters stating that proof of citizenship or a photo ID would be required of all voters going out in states where neither is the law? There have even been a campaign to post the wrong day for the election in some low-income neighborhoods, and another telling people that they could just stay home and vote by phone if they like, which, of course, is not true. You know, do you remember the news story, it still sticks with me, from the 2010 election, of the 86-year-old Ohio, no doubt, veteran who hired a driver because he could no longer drive to take him to the polls to vote? He brought with him his Veterans Administration ID. His driver's license, you see, had expired and couldn't be renewed because he was no longer able to drive. The veteran's ID had his photo and his name, but it did not have his address on it. People at the polls knew who he was, yet he was turned away from performing his civic duty that he'd been so proud to perform for his entire adult life, just like he'd been proud to serve his country in World War II. It's clear to me that these new laws and these intentional misrepresentations of information are attempts to prevent the voices of the poor, the elderly, students, lower working class people, and people who are new to our nation from being heard. And it's really hard for me to understand how people on either side of the political aisle cannot see that this effort is morally wrong. The day after the election, we as members of a faith that holds the inherent and equal worth and dignity of every person as its first principle need to commit ourselves to support those measures that make for the fullest possible participation in our democratic process and encourage, not discourage, every one of our citizens to vote. Finally, on the day after the election, no matter who wins, I hope that those who supported the other candidate or the party will not make it their first agenda item to be as disruptive as possible in order to make sure nothing gets done. One of the members of this congregation who has been actively working in a campaign this season said to me, I have to believe that those in the other party love this country as much as I do, and they too want the best for this country. I'm not asking you to give up your convictions or stop fighting for them, but I do believe in a democratic society, on the day after the election, we are required to pull together. There are so many things on which we agree, so many more than we disagree. We have the same fears and the same hopes. And we cannot be in constant battle. We need to work together as a nation that urgently needs us to address so many problems. You know, fired by partisan media constantly, I think we have lost our compassion for others because they're on the other side of the political aisle. I think we're failing to see the humanity and good intentions of those who differ from us. We seem to have completely forgotten the word compromise and what it means, and how our government, often when it works at its best, has been based on the principle of compromise. In the emotions of the election, we have forgotten the most important thing, that we are one. It seems to me that there are values that transcend our political differences, values that we can uphold together. You know, we can disagree about what should be done about the economy. But down deep, every one of us knows it's wrong and wasteful to have money so pollute our elections that our government is essentially for sale. Down deep, we know it's wrong to make it difficult for people who have the right to vote to exercise that vote. To be a true democracy, we should be removing barriers to voting, not erecting them. And down deep, we all have far more in common and share many values with those who will vote differently from us. And although we want everything our way, deep down, we know that compromise is what the political process is in fact all about. And at the very deepest level, the level of our faith, we know we're one. At election time, I'm always proud to be an American, but I'm also proud to be a Unitarian Universalist, a member of a faith that affirms the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. Voting for us should be our sacred duty. We're called to participate fully and honestly and to bring our moral convictions to that ballot box. And then comes the day after the election, and things change. We should not live in anger and work towards the failure of whoever is elected. Yes, be the loyal opposition where you must, but remember, the values we share are far greater than those that divide us, and that we are all one. These are the things I hope we can all agree on and begin to act upon the day after the election, regardless of who wins.